In this session, we have Professor Endicott. I don't need to present him. We all know, he's very well known among us for his work in legal theory. He's also interested, I read recently, in constitutional administrative law. But today he's presenting a paper about the limits of legal interpretation. Professor Endicott.
Thank you very much, Diego. It's a real privilege to be here. I'm so glad that we're doing this. It's a privilege for me to be able to hear John Finnis speak any opportunity. And I'm really delighted to have been here for Paul Brady's paper. And you could say that what I'm going to do today is a sort of, it might be thought of as a prelude to the last sentence of Paul's paper. Closer. Right. Thanks. And it's good to come from Oxford, where, as John Finnis said, there's a thriving community of people doing legal philosophy, to another university with a thriving community. And I'm really glad to be here. What I'm going to do this afternoon is a sort of exercise in skepticism. I think we need some skepticism today. You're free to participate in it, and I hope you will, but you're also free to go to sleep. And after that wonderful lunch, I wouldn't blame you, and I'll wake you up in time for Nicola's paper. But if you stay awake, I'd appreciate your help. I'm going to see what I can do to argue that interpretation plays virtually no role in legal reasoning, and see where we get. I will mention a potential objection to this claim before we finish that arises out of what Professor Finnis and Paul said this morning. So I may not be as mad as I sound. I'm going to see where we can get by arguing that interpretation is its role in legal reasoning is very strictly limited. I'm sorry that I'm not sorry that I need to speak in English because not everyone here speaks the same language. But I'm sorry that those of you who don't speak English will have to study with me some passages of English which I've put on the handout. This is work towards a book on law and language, and interpretation will come into that project. But it's not a specifically linguistic problem that we're talking about today, but I'm going to use some examples of communication in the English language. And I'm sorry, so I'll slow down. I'm going to have to talk pretty fast because there's too much going on in what I'm working on. But I'll slow down on the parts where you need to pay attention to a bit of the English language. By legal reasoning, by the way, I mean, well, something like what Paul Brady means when he talks about judicial reasoning, but I extend it more broadly to the reasoning that anyone who's not a judge might need to do in order to decide what is to be done according to law on some issue. And so I'm speaking about very practical questions of how to behave. And in the reasoning, the finding of support for conclusions on such questions, I'll argue that interpretation is of minimal importance. It's of importance, but not, it's not all it's cracked up to be. And I'm not going to offer you a theory of interpretation. I don't have one, but I've put the first set of bullet points on the handout are some propositions that I want to suggest would be part of a good theory of a good explanation of what interpretation is, that I hope will be not too contentious. Interpretation has an object. I say on the handout that a good interpretation always depends on truths about the object. I guess you could state it more rigorously by saying that in a good interpretation there would be a good complete interpretation would include propositions that refer to the object of interpretation. There's a pretty minimal sort of claim about the relation between an interpretation and its object. But an interpretation is also creative. The interpreter must make something new out of the object and won't have succeeded in interpreting it without stating some truth that, in some sense, and I use that phrase because I find this very difficult, is not about the object. That this is a weak point in what I'm doing, that, and I don't know if it will get stronger before I finish. Interpretation is a process or an activity, and it's a rational process or activity. It's an activity of reasoning. It can be interpretation. A good interpretation is based on good reasons, and interpretations are propositional. That is, you can express them in the statement of a proposition. An interpretation, as Joseph Raz says in the remarkable work that he's done on interpretation, which John Finnis referred to this morning, gives or shows or determines the meaning or a meaning of the object. You can find that in Joseph Raz. You can also find it in the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, which I may refer to because it comes into the work that I'm going to do on a particular case. In the relevant sense for what we're doing today, interpretation gives a rule for the application of the law. You could interpret English law as patriarchal or oppressive or something else, and that wouldn't be the sort of interpretation that I'm going to be talking about today. I'm going to be talking about an interpretation that could conceivably aid in a decision as to what is to be done according to law, and argue that's not as important as people tend to think it is. This tendency, by the way, is a tendency of legal philosophers and also a tendency of judges. The tendency to think of law as interpretation, if I can just basically tell you the motivation for what I'm trying to do, is, I think, dangerous to a good understanding of law, both for the theorist and for the practitioner and for the citizen and for the judge, and it's especially dangerous, I'm going to argue, for the judge. Thinking of law as interpretation, and you can see how it happens. Here's the fallacy. Interpretation is a reasoning activity that must be faithful to its objects and yet must do something creative in order to decide what is to be done in light of the object. Legal reasoning is a process of reasoning that must be faithful to its objects and yet often needs to do something creative in order to decide what is to be done in light of the objects that we start with. And the easy fallacy is to think that, therefore, legal reasoning is a form of interpretation. And basically what I want to argue, and I hope this argument will survive whatever happens when my skepticism is refuted and doesn't go as far as I'm going to try to push it. What I hope will survive is the idea that thinking of law as interpretation misunderstands just how extravagantly the law, in a good law, in a good community, leaves matters of judgment to others and resolution of disputes over matters of judgment to courts and other tribunals. And thinking of law as interpretation also misses or misunderstands how simply and tightly and transparently and uncontroversially the law may constrain persons and therefore tribunals. So I think that these are practically dangerous misunderstandings for judges in particular and for any of us, and they're theoretically dangerous misunderstandings for legal theorists. And the second set of bullet points is a set of activities that are part of legal reasoning that are not generally interpretative. And rather than go through them, I'm going to come back to them in light of the problems of interpretation that you'll find on the second page of the handout. This is where I'm going to have to talk pretty quickly to tell the story, but I'll slow down to look at the language that is being interpreted in these cases. Bankovic in Belgium, I'm going to start with, because it's the case that got me interested in this problem. And some of you will be very familiar with it. It is the leading case in the European Court of Human Rights on the extraterritorial application of the of the European Convention on Human Rights, and I'm sorry if this is going to get technical for those of you who aren't familiar with this this area of the law. When NATO decided to bomb the television station in the center of the Serbian capital in the mid-1990s in order to put pressure on Serbia to go along with the policy on Kosovo and Serbia that the NATO nations had agreed on. They wanted to put pressure on Serbia. They bombed Serbia, and the Bankovics were a couple whose daughter was killed in the bombing, and they went to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg and argued that her right to life had been violated by the state parties to the European Convention who were part of the NATO bombing mission. And the countries that were brought before the court said that the European Convention did not apply. And they said that because of Article 1 of the Convention, which is printed on the handout, and Article 1 of the European Convention says that the high contracting parties shall secure to everyone within their jurisdiction the rights and freedoms. Now, I recommend that you read the Bankovic case. The Strasbourg court proceeds in the way that they're invited to proceed by the lawyers for the two parties. And they start by quoting the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties to set the scene for the question of how one interprets treaties. And they frame the problem for themselves as a problem of interpretation. And it strikes me reading the case that that's a mistake. Actually quite a radical mistake, and a radical mistake with damaging consequences for the way they decide the case. The problem of interpretation that they set for themselves is how to interpret the provision of the convention that the contracting parties, the states that have been brought before the court, shall secure to everyone within their jurisdiction the rights and freedoms that are guaranteed. The question before the court is whether the young woman who was killed in the bombing raid was within the jurisdiction of Belgium. They need to decide that. And they frame the problem for themselves as a question of how to interpret the provision in the convention that the state shall guarantee the rights within their jurisdiction. And it seems to me that a court cannot decide whether the injury took place within the jurisdiction of a state by interpreting the proposition in the convention that the convention applies within the jurisdiction of the state. That's what got me interested in this problem. This seems to me the most striking example of something that I think courts do again and again, given by a lawmaker the responsibility for determining the effect of a legal regime in some aspect that has come into dispute. They want to portray what they're doing as an interpretation of the lawmaking act, of the lawmaker that gave them the responsibility to do it. And it strikes me again and again, teaching, as Diego mentioned, teaching English public law to students in Oxford. Again and again, it strikes me that the courts seek to portray the discharge of responsibility that's been given to them as an interpretation of an act of another authority. You can see how this is part of the impulse to portray legal reasoning as interpretative, and it reflects a sort of either an emotional on the part of the individual judges or a political need to present the judicial act as based on authority rather than as an arrogation to themselves or as a presumptuous claim of authority on their own part. And a court put in the predicament by another lawmaker of needing to discharge a responsibility to determine the effect of the law on some question has this tendency to portray what they're doing as the interpretation of the act of the other lawmaker. I think that's what happened in the Bankovich case, and it's doomed because of the impossibility of deciding what jurisdiction is by interpreting a provision that simply uses the term jurisdiction. I'm going to come back to this because there's an obvious objection to what I've said, and I'll come back, and I promise I'll tell you the obvious objection and what I think remains in what I'm saying after we understand the objection. But I just want to start with this as one aspect of legal reasoning in which interpretation isn't all it's cracked up to be. Courts and tribunals cannot use interpretation to answer questions that the lawmaker has left to the court or tribunal. I'll come back to that. The second instance of interpretation on the handout is from a short story by an English comic author, P.G. Woodhouse, and maybe some of you have read some of these countless stories about a young man called Bertie Wooster and his butler. This is in the 1930s. Bertie Wooster, to crudely oversimplify the situation, he's very rich and very stupid upper-class Englishman, and yet he triumphs again and again in the most outrageous predicaments and comes through with flying colors because he has a butler who is deeply intelligent. And in the passage that you have on your handout, Bertie Wooster is the first speaker and Jeeves, the butler, is the second speaker. And Bertie has received a telegram from his friend Tuppy, and he is baffled by the telegram. And he says to Jeeves, his butler, "I will read it to you. Hand it in at upper bleaching. Message runs as follows. When you come tomorrow, bring my football boots. Also, if humanly possible, Irish water spaniel. Urgent. Regards, Tuppy." "What do you make of that, Jeeves?" says Bertie. And here's Jeeves' answer. "As I interpret the document, sir, Mr. Glossop wishes you, when you come tomorrow, to bring his football boots. Also, if humanly possible, an Irish water spaniel. He hints that the matter is urgent and sends his regards." "Yes," says Bertie, "that's how I read it too, but why football boots?" Now, this goes back to a point this morning about arguments that aren't arguments and laws that aren't laws. This is an interpretation that's not an interpretation, and that's the joke. Bertie's predicament is he doesn't know why Tuppy is asking for these things, and it's not, he doesn't need an interpretation. And for Jeeves to say what he says is not to give an interpretation. And this, I just gave you this little interpretation that isn't an interpretation as a reminder that there's another aspect of legal reasoning, if reasoning is even the right word for it, that one might be tempted to think of as interpretative, but is not. And that is what I called on the other side of the handout the intellection of law. That I just used that instead of understanding, because understanding is used in so diverse fashions. The grasp of the meaning of the law is not fundamentally an interpretative task. And to this we might add what doesn't arise out of this passage from P.G. Woodhouse's story, that the as I claim on the other side of the handout, that the application of the law is not an interpretative task. And I think that follows as a matter of either what Wittgenstein called grammar or as a matter of logic, from the fact that to say otherwise would create an infinite regress in which every interpretation needs a new interpretation before we can apply it. So I think it's a very important aspect of legal reasoning that very often it is possible to grasp, to understand the law, and also to apply it without interpreting it at all. And it's conceivable that in order to comply with Tuppy's request, Bertie might need to do some sort of interpretation. And that might arise, for example, if there are, Tuppy has two pairs of football boots and Birdie needs to work out in a way that's faithful to this telegram, but adds to it something creative on Birdie's part, some reason for making of Tuppy's request, a request for those football boots rather than the other ones. So you can easily imagine Bertie needing to interpret, but you can also easily imagine a situation in which there is no task of interpretation whatsoever for Bertie to do in complying, if he sets out to comply with Tuppy's request. Now, I think there are many legal theorists these days who would agree with me about this point, that that when it's determinate what the law requires and it can be grasped without interpretation, then this is a good example of the limits of the role of legal interpretation, of interpretation in legal reasoning. But then I think we have to put this together with the first point, because there's a tendency among some legal theorists who are not at all like Ronald Dworkin and don't think it's all interpretation, to think that interpretation begins when legal determinacy ends. So that if the law is determinate or this request is determinate, that it applies to these football boots and we don't need interpretation to determine that and we can carry it out, then there's no role for interpretation. But when the law is indeterminate, then we need to engage in interpretation. And I think it's quite important to remember that, in fact, when the law is indeterminate, there's no role for interpretation. Concluding that the law is indeterminate in its requirements on some point might be the conclusion of a good interpretation. If it's true, then there is no role for interpretation, it seems to me. If there were a role for interpretation, what there would be a role for is a process of reasoning by which reasons for this conclusion rather than that might be reached. And then the requirements of the law would not be indeterminate. And there would be a role for interpretation, but the law wouldn't be indeterminate. If the law is indeterminate, it seems to me there's no role for interpretation. Now, if it's starting to sound as if I think there's no such thing in interpretation, I just want no such thing as a role for interpretation in legal reasoning or in practical reasoning in general. I wanted to give an example of the sort of situation in which interpretation is important and necessary in order to solve a problem. And for that, I've given you another famous example of an interpretation, actual, real life. From the Crimean War, Lord Raglan is standing up above the battle, and sends an orderly with a command to the commander of the troops, who is in charge of the light brigade, a brigade of about 600 light cavalry, And Lord Raglan sees the battle, and there's a long valley, and on either sides of it, the Russian troops are lined up, and at the end of the valley are the heavy guns, the main Russian artillery emplacement. And at the other end of the valley stand the light brigade, ready to go into battle. And he sends with his orderly the order that is written out word for word on your handout. Lord Raglan wishes the cavalry to advance rapidly to the front, follow the enemy, and try to prevent the enemy carrying away the guns. Troop horse artillery may accompany. French cavalry is on your left. Full stop. And this badly formed order creates a need for interpretation, partly because of the purportedly definite descriptions, the guns, the front. The enemy. We can put it down to the haste of battle, but Lord Raglan didn't specify some things that the commander needed specified. And then potentially there's a task for for the commander to do in interpreting the order, in a way that's faithful to the command, bringing to it, adding to it, making of it something that solves the question of which guns we are to prevent the enemy from carrying away, or what the front refers to, or which of the various parts of the Russian forces might be referred to by the term the enemy. The commander tried to solve this problem by asking the captain, the orderly who had brought the order, and according to what I've read, the man who'd just brought this order and was exhausted and out of breath just waved like that. And the commander came to the conclusion that he was being directed by Lord Raglan to send the light brigade, the 600 troops, straight down the valley between the Russian emplacements to attack the Russian artillery at the end. And he does so, and off they go, and most of them die, and it's a tremendous sort of tragic victory that any of them at all get as far as the artillery, and a few dozen get all the way back again. And Tennyson writes a famous poem about it, and it turns into a public debate in Britain. This was a military disaster, although the British are rather pleased with it because it was so dashing and tragic and brave. But there are bad consequences in the English ruling classes. And Lord Raglan, in the ensuing public controversy, was deeply critical of the commander and said that he had a misconception of the order, right? A misinterpretation. He misinterpreted the order by concluding that, and by the way, it's a very confusing controversy, and I think that the commander had both misunderstood which guns were being referred to, but had also come to the conclusion that Lord Raglan criticized. And the interpretive conclusion, according to Lord Raglan, that the commander had come to was, as Lord Raglan put it, that they were to attack the guns at all hazards. So there the person who issued the command is saying, he has misinterpreted what I said by coming to the conclusion that the 600 were to attack the guns at all hazards, no matter what. So he should have interpreted my order as what? As something like an order that they are to attack the guns if possible, if reasonably possible, if possible without disastrous loss of life, if it's not going to be a military disaster. The man who issued the order is saying that the commander had an interpretive responsibility to temper the simple proposition, prevent the enemy from carrying the guns away, with a concern for a reasonable approach to the danger to his own troops. Now, this, I think, is a really important kind of interpretative reasoning that we might describe in two ways. Let's suppose for a moment that the commander did make a mistake, having received that order, in sending the troops to their death. We could describe the mistake in two ways. One of them is very attractive to my skeptical approach to legal interpretation. We could say either, and here's the account of the right reasoning process for the commander that is faithful to my skeptical approach to interpretation. We could say either that there is no problem of interpretation for the commander, it's perfectly clear what is being commanded. In respect of his responsibility to determine the meaning of this piece of writing, to give it a meaning, to not simply to understand the words, but to bring to it a grasp of the concept of the context that enables him to make out of it an order. All he has to do is to understand that he's being directed to prevent the enemy from getting to the guns. But then he ought, as a responsible commander, to be reasoning in a way that is for the good fulfillment of his role as a commander, in a way that's responsible, accountable to his superiors and to his men, for the good conduct of the war, insofar as he's carrying out a role as a commander. So he needs both to interpret this order, and that's easy. It says attack the guns, subject to the question of which guns are being referred to. But he also needs to act responsibly as a commander, and not to give effect to an order in a way that is destructive to the very military purpose that he's required to carry out. That's one way of describing it. The second way of describing it is to say that in reaching that, what he ought to have done, in reaching the conclusion that those guns are not to be attacked in a way that merely destroys the light brigade, his task was precisely to understand Lord Raglan, to give a meaning to what Lord Raglan had said, that itself, as part of the interpretative act, involves the proposition that destroying the light brigade instead of destroying the guns at the end of the valley is a bad idea. So there's a question I want to put to you. The proposition that the light brigade should not be sent down the valley to its destruction in a mere pretense at an effort to destroy the guns. That proposition of reason, is it well described as an interpretative reason? Or as a reason that's within the overall responsibility of the commander, as a commander, and not part of a good interpretation? I think we all ought to be rather ambivalent about this. Why would you conclude that the troops shouldn't be sent down the valley to their destruction? Well, how about this? In favor of my skeptical approach to interpretation, the reason is not actually anything about Lord Raglan or what he has said, right? There's nothing about Lord Raglan's act of communication, and that's the object, by the way. The object of the interpretation isn't simply the words. The object of interpretation is, you might say, the fact that Lord Raglan, in this context, in the British Army, in this particular military campaign, on that day, in light of this lineup of the Russian forces and Lord Raglan's responsibility for overall command and his knowledge of the British forces, the fact that Lord Raglan said to attack the guns, that's the fact that he made that communication, that is what the commander needs to interpret. And there's nothing about that fact that requires that the light brigade not be sent down the valley. What requires that the light brigade not be sent down the valley is that it would be destructive to the very purpose of the military adventure or military operation. So that's why I'm inclined to say that this isn't a question of interpretation at all. The question, why should I send them down the valley? The answer is no, I shouldn't. And the reason not to is not an interpretative reason. That's what I want to say. And yet, Lord Raglan didn't see it that way. He thought that his order had been misconceived by the commander. His order should have been understood as an order that involved a responsibility not to destroy the light brigade. So that this is a sort of ambivalence that I'm working with, and I'll leave you with There are many reasons for conclusions in legal reasoning that might be described as an interpretation of the act of legislation. There's a famous one in English law. Suppose that the legislature gives a public authority the power to dismiss employees. Full stop. Does the employee have a right to a hearing before he or she is dismissed? The answer is yes. And in English public law, there are many academics who say the answer is yes because that's the best interpretation of the act of the legislature giving the power to dismiss. The legislature must have intended that the employee should have a fair hearing before the public authority dismisses them. And there are others who say, no, no, the reason that the employee has a right to a hearing before she is dismissed is not that that's the best interpretation of the legislation, it's the common law. The common law made by the judges imposes on the public authority a duty to give a fair hearing, a duty to give due process before dismissing the employee. And there you see the same ambivalence that we might feel in as theorists in explaining what's going on in the situation. And here what seems important to me is that there's nothing about what the legislature did when it gave the power that necessitates the conclusion that the employee should have a hearing. What necessitates it is a requirement of justice that the English courts have felt free to act on. But of course, when they've done it, they've often described themselves as giving effect to what the legislature did when it conferred the power. Now, I think that when they do that, that arises out of what I suggested earlier about the part psychological and part political need of judges to account for what they're doing, their tendency to account for what they're doing, as an interpretation of the authoritative act in the special English constitutional context, an act of a parliament that's conceived as supreme. Now, so there are some of the skeptical the implications of the skeptical approach I take to the role of interpretation. I want to go back briefly before I finish to the Bankovich case. Now, remember in Bankovich, I think it's quite dramatic. They set out on a doomed effort to interpret the word jurisdiction in order to decide what jurisdiction is, and this is impossible. And I think there is no interpretative solution to the question of the extent of the effect of Article 1 of the European Convention. It is the fallout from the Bankovich case is still being worked out, and some of you will know more about this than I do. There were already cases before Bankovich that suggested quite a wide application of the convention beyond the territory of the state. And the court in this case was stuck with that. What they did in the Bankovich case was to, remember they said, we have to interpret jurisdiction so that they must have used that term in the sense in which it's used in international law. And in international law, jurisdiction is primarily territorial, subject to exceptions, and we don't find any exception in this case, so there is no jurisdiction. And that turns out to be rather incoherent and catastrophic in later cases because of the, I think, misapprehension that jurisdiction is a single thing in international law, when in fact, jurisdiction is simply the power to say and to say with legal effect that the law is this rather than that, or that the effect of the law shall be this or rather than that. And that's an extremely diverse power which is had in international law as in domestic law for different purposes in different contexts. And there's a remarkable English case in which the mother of a British soldier who died in Iraq claims that her son's right to life under the convention was infringed. And the British House of Lords applies Bankovich and the other Strasbourg cases and says that he was only within the jurisdiction of the United Kingdom while he was on a British base in Iraq and not while he was out on patrol. So if he died out on patrol in Iraq, he is not covered by the convention. And if he died on a British base in Iraq, he is within the convention. And the absurdity of this is that it's perfectly obvious and undeniable that he is within British jurisdiction. If we step back from the European Convention for ourselves for a minute and ask, is he within British jurisdiction? Of course he is, as a member of the United Kingdom Armed Forces. So the result of Bankovich is to kind of lose a grasp of what is to be determined. And what is to be determined, of course, according to Article 1, is the extent of the convention, and it's a question that was simply left to the judges by the framers of the convention. But here's the potential objection to what I'm saying about Bankovich. As they mention, as the Strasbourg judges mention in their decision in Bankovich, and here again the Vienna Convention comes in, because the Vienna Convention says that you can look at the travaux préparatoires for certain purposes, and they look at the negotiations in the drafting of the convention, and an initial draft of Article 1 said that the states shall undertake to ensure to all persons residing within their territories the rights. That draft was changed, and it was changed according to the court, because the commission drafting the convention decided that residing was rather dangerous, that might be too restrictive. It would exempt from the protection of the convention a person who's within the territory but doesn't reside in Britain or Belgium. But they didn't change it to all persons within their territories. They changed it to all persons within their jurisdiction. And now, this is an interpretative question, it seems to me. What are the implications of that drafting process for an understanding of Article 1? And maybe, I think this may be the case, maybe when they wrote Article 1 as it is now, as it was adopted, they were using the word jurisdiction in the way it is sometimes used, as a mere synonym for territory. We don't know, and it was already too late in the Bankovich case for the Strasbourg court because of earlier cases extending the convention beyond the territory. But in that change, there is grounds for an interpretative argument about the effect of Article 1. And the effect that I say it has, which is simply to leave to the judges the responsibility to determine the extent of the protection given by the convention, is itself, of course, an interpretative conclusion. And the conclusion is that in that change in the drafting, they decided not to decide what the extent of the jurisdiction is. They decided to leave it to the judges. So even the sort of conclusion that I think is a conclusion that judges find it hard to face up to, the conclusion that the lawmaker has decided not to decide but to leave it to the decision maker, that itself is an interpretative conclusion. And of course, this is an aspect of what I suggested at the beginning, is a potential objection to everything I'm saying, which arises, I think, from a remark that John Finnis made this morning about how the value of the positivity of law isn't lost if we recognize the interpretative devices that are involved in legal reasoning. And there's obviously something important to that. In a passage from Finnis that's quoted on the last page of Paul Brady's paper, we read this. In no legal system responsive to human needs do citizens, judges, or other officials look to the bare social fact of a past legislative act or act of adjudication. Always the reference is to such acts in their intrasystemic context. And there, you might say, is part of an argument to the contrary of everything I've been saying, that actually all legal reasoning, insofar as it's the grasp of the objects, the acts of lawmakers, and the material that a legal decision must be based upon. All of that can only well be done in light of an understanding of the specifically legal context in which a decision is being made. And I think that's true, but yet there are two reasons why I still adhere to this skeptical view of the role of interpretation. First of all, that in particular is not something distinctive about law and all understanding of acts of authority in general, but perhaps of acts of communication in general, depends on the context. And while Finnis adds something specifically interesting about law, the intrasystemic context, I don't think that detracts from the second reason why the importance of the context to legal reasoning is compatible with my skeptical approach to interpretation. And that reason is that understood in its context, in its intrasystemic context, within a remarkable, complex, bizarre system, the act of the Council of Europe and of the member states that sign up to the European Convention of adopting Article 1 as a statement of the extent of the convention, understood in its context, is best understood as an act that confers on the court and the power and imposes on them the responsibility to decide the jurisdiction of Belgium and of the other countries for the purposes of the convention. So everything that I've said about, that's skeptical about the role of interpretation, I think can be said compatibly with the importance of the specifically legal context for all legal reasoning and for the decision of any, the resolution of any particular dispute about the law. So I think I've done my best to be skeptical about the role of interpretation in law. Of course, it is important. It's important in the determination of facts by a legal tribunal or court. Maybe it's even more important in the determination of the law, but not much more in my skeptical view. It's not necessarily an interpretative task to understand the law, but it can be. Resolving indeterminacies in the law is necessarily non-interpretative. What I call on the handout equitable dispensation from or interference with legal rights or duties, well, that could be interpretative insofar as some communicative act of an authority has required it and needs to be interpreted in order to understand the extent of the requirement, but is not generally interpretative. Developing, changing the law, not interpretative. Applying the law, not interpretative. And working out what the jurisdiction of Belgium is for the purposes of the European Convention in the Strasbourg Court, given Article 1, is, in my view, definitely not an interpretative task. And generally deciding what is just is not an interpretative task. Thanks.